You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Star Wars Beyond the Films. This is episode number 5, coming to you in early February of 2012. Of course, we are now a month removed from the release of Darth Plagueis, and that will be our topic this time around. In fact, our topic in many ways for this entire month. I am one of your hosts, Nathan P. Butler, of course, from StarWarsFanWorks.com. We have a new Facebook page for that, by the way, along with our Facebook page here for Star Wars Beyond the Films. And joining me is actually a pair of Star Wars fans here. We have my constant companion, Mr. Mark Herleman. Hey, Mark.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? Glad to be here. Me and Whistler just got done with the Star Wars reports last month and decided, hey, you know, let's do some time traveling. Hey, it worked for the Jedi and Riptide and Cross Current. Now knock it off.
Yeah, you can only go forward, though, so don't even try to go backwards. Joining us also is Mr. Pete, or Peter, a little more professional sounding, sir. Mr. Peter Morrison of the awesome Star Wars blog site, Lightsaber Rattling. Hey, Pete, how are you?
Hello, guys. Greetings all.
Hey. I'm going to have a hard time calling you Peter. I just got to say that right now because I don't know, naturally equate you to Parker, Peter Parker, and I always call him Pete in my mind, so I apologize now.
Well, if you call me Peter Parker, you know, that's not the worst insult in the world.
If you start calling him Tiger like Mary Jane, I may have to cut out early. I'm just saying.
Things are getting weird.
Yeah. All right, well, our topic this time around, folks, is going to be Darth Plagueis, the recently released novel by James Luceno. But that means that this episode is going to be spoiler-filled. This episode we're going to deal with part 1, next episode part 2, the episode after that part 3. And in each case, we're going to be talking about those parts in spoilerific fashion here. It's not really a novel you can talk about in much detail without getting into spoilers. So if you have not read Darth Plagueis, you might want to read that and then come back to these episodes. If you have, then hopefully you'll be able to share some of your thoughts upon hearing our thoughts on the Facebook page for Star Wars Beyond the Films. Just look it up by that name, or maybe with us through Twitter, at @SWBeyondFilms. The first part here is entitled Enlistment. And Mark, being as you were the one who first suggested this topic, why don't you take it on from here?
Well, you know, I found it interesting, like, Enlistment starts off, but it's like not really the first part. We have a very mild prologue that kicks off right before it, where we see Lord Sidious, Emperor Palpatine, although he's not Emperor at this time, killing his master, which we know is Darth Plagueis. But when part one comes on, it's the next chapter, and, well, it's actually chapter one, because technically it's a prologue, but the underworld, and we see basically a fly back, in a sense. You go way back to Plagueis killing his master, Darth Tenebris. And I found that this chapter it worked for me. I was enjoying it. I'm enjoying this book right away. As soon as I grabbed it, I was enjoying it. You know, you open it up and you see that first little key point. This story is canon. I was excited from there on in. But I like the way that the prologue set things up, and then you jump into this. It's like the first two chapters, you watch two Sith Lords die, and it's almost like you're going back in time. I was expecting chapter 3 to start with Tenebris killing his master. I don't know. So it's one of those things where, you know, as you get into it, it jumps right in. We see that they're doing some mining stuff on a planet. I believe it's Baldemic. And it's one of those things where the details of this book is what really sold it for me. I don't know about you guys, but I don't know. The whole alter ego thing as it built up, the way it was kind of slid into the chapter really worked a lot. What do you guys think about that?
Was I the only one that was absolutely shocked by the species of Darth Tenebris? I couldn't get over the fact that he's a Bith. That just made me stop for a whole minute and put down the book and be like, really? Did he just do that? That's the silliest looking Sith Lord I can think of.
You know, there were rumors that there were actually 4 of them before him, and that they tended, just like Tenebris, to not really say a whole lot, to speak only when necessary. But it turns out that that's non-canon. That was just, you know, some junk out there, like a super shadow thing. So there is no truth to the fifth Bith Sith with pith myth out there. Yes, I know, long set up for a bad joke. I've been sitting on that one for a while. But no, I agree. It seems like it makes perfect sense when you actually read what Lucino's writing here, because he's trying to sort of build up this idea that the quest for immortality, the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise, actually begins with Darth Tenebus the Wrinkly. It's basically Palpatine is trying to learn from Hago Damask / Darth Plagueis, but Plagueis's search for immortality is just sort of the metaphysical version of a more scientific search for the same type of thing that Darth Tenebris was trying to do. And if you're going to have something very scientific and you want someone to be able to use their force powers to enhance perhaps intelligence or perceptions for something like that, it only makes sense it has to be someone with a higher brain function, you know, than a regular sentient that we would see in the Star Wars galaxy. So a Bith, it seems odd. I don't think a Bith would look really threatening if they were looking at you, but, you know, they sort of fit from the standpoint of what I guess he was trying to do with this whole backstory of why is it they would have been searching. And he does a really good job of weaving in that backstory. Mark mentioned the fact that, you know, there's a lot of detail to this. Shout out here to Sith Ari, who I believe is a poster over on the Port Haven message boards, who referred to this as being written by the Lucinopedia. And that really is kind of what it is. James Lucino does an amazing, amazing job here of weaving a massive amount of material together, though not necessarily all in part one. Part one is a lot of references. He's not really touching on other stories except Stover's The Tenebrous Way, which of course was written to coincide with this as opposed to being something earlier. Now, there is one big continuity issue that popped up to me, or a chronological issue that popped up to me when I first opened part one. Did either of you catch the fact that the first two words or the first sentence of part one doesn't match the opening page of part one that tells you the date of the story?
When I was looking at it, I thought that that was kind of like a point of view thing. Like obviously chapter one, I don't know. I thought like whoever was telling this portion of it didn't look at the grander scheme that the first part encompassed. I don't know. That's kind of where I went with it, but you definitely pointed out, I was like, oh, you're right. They don't quite add up.
Yeah, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, it says part one, enlistment, 67 to 65 years before the Battle of Yavin. Then the very first sentence says 47 standard years before the harrowing reign of Emperor Palpatine, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you do the math, 47, 19 BBY, oh, that's 66. So essentially, from what I can tell, and from what the Timeline Gold's going to reflect, too, which also has a Facebook page, by the way, I'm just plugging like crazy tonight. You'll find that I think it's taking place in 66 and 65. It doesn't seem as though it really makes sense for this to all be taking place in 67 through 65. It also doesn't seem like it stretches that much in terms of the story duration anyway, for me.
See, I found the 47 standard years. I just saw that as a reference to Baldemic and the state of Baldemic at that time. That's where I kind of ran with it, because, you know, they go on and it's talking Baldemic was nothing more than an embryonic world in the outer rim on the Aurora sector, you know, populated by reptilian sentients. But that was kind of where I was thinking where they were going with it, was just, you know, whoever was doing the research only looked so far back, whereas the actual part itself told us what years it was going to encompass. I mean, that was kind of where I went with it. The thing I found funny, though, is, you know, they're doing this bit where there's a tread droid, and it's talking to Tenebris and them, and he's just like, oh, I'm pretty much going to blow up, you know? And Plagueis, like, he understands. He's like, you've been useful, droid. I thought that was an interesting little touch. And later throughout the book, we kind of see that side of Plagueis kind of explored a little bit, and that he had a soft side for things. And I think in a lot of ways that was his undoing with Sidious. But I thought it was a nice touch. And then later with 11-4D, how, you know, he kind of like comes to treat the droid as a companion. I just found that in this little chapter, that little reference there kind of got my brain going, like, I wonder what kind of Sith Lord he's going to be.
Come see the softer side of Sith, right? Or is that Seers? I always get those two confused. They're both evil sometimes, though.
That's right. See, that's the thing. This book, I have got it so dog-eared. It's not even funny. I mean, I have to go through the book and literally undog-ear everything before I can hand it to my dad, because it is like accordioned at each corner. I'm like, oh, I don't want to forget about this, and I don't want to forget about that. And I think that, to a degree, that that's part of the problem with this book for some people, because, you know, I've seen some people where they're having problems with the Lucinopedia part of things. I felt that this book, out of all Lucino's books, I felt he did a good job of toning that back for once, but
Whoa.
I don't know. Maybe I'm getting better at recognizing his words. I don't know. Normally I'm busting out like a dictionary going, what in the heck did he just say? But I don't know. This time, maybe I was half asleep during half the parts. I don't know. I didn't catch that.
I definitely thought there was too much going on.
Go for it.
You said it seems like he sort of toned back the Lucinopedia stuff. This is the book that, you know, we're out there and people are commenting frequently online, the early reviewers, about how he's using these giant words that almost ask you to have a dictionary nearby. But fortunately, he's usually only using those with Plagueis and Tenebris, as opposed to using it with Palpatine, which would have possibly seemed a little bit out of character. But no, I'm taking notes for this for the timeline. Anytime I read one of these books, I'm sort of doing double duty here. I'm trying to read it for fun and for discussion, I guess, here now, later. But that's not one of the things I usually tend to focus on, because I want to, you know, process it first. But the second thing I'm trying to do is take notes on it at any given time. You know, I'm either busting out the iPad and typing out some quick notes, or I'm doing some quick notes on a little microcassette recorder, or just jotting it down on paper. And it turned out when I took this book and put it on the Star Wars Timeline Gold. It's not a version that's out yet. It's going to be the next one, the 50th gold one later on, the one that finally passes 2,000 stinking pages. But when I put that together, I had to divide this book into around 15 to 20 different parts to fit it all in, because of how many different times it jumps in time and how many different things it crosses over with. I had to add stuff to the Phantom Menace summary to make it all fit. And from the Lucinopedia standpoint, I wound up with somewhere between 35 and 40 separate little new references that needed to be put in there. Like, 5 years ago this happened, 10 years ago this happened, when this character was 17 or 2 or whatever. It seemed as though the Lucinopedia thing was on overdrive, not just with the references from the outside, but essentially creating his own new entries in the Lucinopedia, so to speak. He got really sort of immersed in adding the little chronological nuances and such this time around. And fortunately, it didn't seem like there were a lot of glaring holes. How he can do a book like this with 40 or so different references like that, spanning such a large time period, and not seem to have a whole bunch of glaring mistakes, and you can't have freaking Shadow Games without the big glaring Lando thing, is beyond me.
And I think I tend to side more with Nathan on this one, where there's just so much in here. When I was taking notes, I took like 3 full pages of just brief notations from different parts of the book, and there's just so much that he drops in here. It's the way I look at it, it's almost what Timothy Zahn did with Heir to the Empire, where he did little stuff, where he did outbound flight, he mentioned little things. There's so much in here that I want to know more about that. What happened then? Who's this guy? There's a couple of Sith Lords in there, like, ooh, what's going on with that one?
A couple. I counted up. There are 30 different dark side users. Not all of them are Sith Lords per se, but every prominent one, I believe there was 30 by book's end. I was just like, and I believe Revan and Malak were the last two. just kind of like, whoa.
But for me, I guess some people are having trouble with it. Some people are saying it's sort of slowing down the reading experience or the enjoyment, but it worked for me. For whatever reason, it didn't even slow me down one bit. I loved all the little references. It was like candy.
That's how I took it. Exactly, candy. I was just like, ooh, the Ashla, the Boga. Oh my gosh! Oh, the Celestials. Oh, what the Celestials have? They became one with the Force. Whoa! I was just like constantly. I wanted to know so much more about the stuff. I'm like, is this gonna all like come out in Dawn of the Jedi later? You know, I was like, how is this working? Is he talking to people? Oh man, I hope he's talking to people. Are they writing this down? Because I was just blown away. I kept going back to that first line on the cover. This book is canon. And I loved how on Star Wars Report, Aaron Goins, he used that reference. I thought about doing it with my review, and I didn't. And I love that he did, because that was something that jumped out at me right out the gate. When I grabbed the book, the first thing I saw was that, and I stopped, I think, about a good 10 minutes contemplating in my mind what that meant. I mean, you know, they say, this story is canon. The background of Darth Plagueis and Darth Sidious was developed hand in glove with the highest authorities at Lucasfilm to ensure that nothing contradicts George Lucas's vision of his creations. And we all know how George's vision spans, changes, and transforms daily. So I just, that made me stop and think. I mean, and there were lots of times in this book I did stop and think, but for me, that didn't stop the enjoyment. I enjoyed stopping and thinking about things.
See, I gotta say, I'm sitting here saying, oh, really? Because I'm assuming you guys were both reading from the advanced reader copy. for me, for some reason, when I get an advanced reader copy, my advanced reader copy is not the one that you guys get that had that sort of unfinished cover thing. What winds up happening with me is they'll send me the final version of the book, the retail version, but they'll do it a few weeks early. So you guys will get your advanced reader copies way before I do. I'll get mine, and then right after mine, within about a month, that's when it actually comes out. So there's no canonical reference sitting there. What I find interesting, just going back to just the sheer amount of references and stuff that are made in here, Darth Gravid, for instance, things like that, they do a very good job of that. What stands out to me as far as the Sith go is the way they personified or the way they portrayed the major Sith in here. Because, yeah, there's a ton of Sibes. Darth Ramage, I think, is how you're supposed to say it. It's not Rummage, it's not Ravage, it's Ramage. Makes you think he might be a bull of some kind. but they give all this background and fill in the tiny tidbits. But what they've done is they've given some very interesting personas to those Sith, and to tie back into what you're saying there about, you know, looking for the references, and I want to know more about this, I want to know more about that. For me, those references, before we get into the Sith, sort of two trains of thought going at the same time here, for me, it was reading, especially reading the second and third parts, where the second part starts crossing over with Bloodlines, the third part crosses over with virtually everything that was released that is an immediate lead up to The Phantom Menace. So I'm reading it going, okay, where does this fit? Which part of Cloak of Deception is this part crossing over with and such when I'm reading the third part? So to me, it became sort of an exercise in juggling. How do we juggle this part and this part? And he does a very good job of making it all fit, as does, for what it's worth, Ryder Windham with The Wrath of Darth Maul. He does a great job of winding things together. He even has dialogue that matches up virtually perfectly with other sources. But that kind of thing is always appreciated. But I do think there'll be some readers who may not be able to follow it all, as Pete was saying, because you're going to have people who are not familiar with, for instance, Cloak of Deception or Saboteur or the Darth Maul comic or Jedi Council Acts of War, probably because they saw the artwork. And they may be sitting there saying, what on earth is happening? You just told us about this mission for Darth Maul. He's gone. Now he's back. But you're not telling us about the mission itself. Okay, all of a sudden, Newt Gunray is promoted here, and the Executive Council of the Trade Federation is gone, and now they're Nemoidians. That happened where? That happened when? I got a feeling there's going to be some level of confusion. On the Sith, I would say what struck me was how well they portray the three that we see specifically in this first part. Darth Venomous, the other apprentice, from when Sidious taunted Maul that there might be another apprentice, and it turned out to be a lie back in the Maul journal, which is also in Wrath of Darth Maul, repeated. But here, you know, there really is another apprentice, perhaps, if
I love that, like, too. The fact that it was another Bith. I was like, oh, he's alive? What?
And this guy, Venomous, at one point, we find out that he has been masquerading as a doctor. So he might have been a doctor in his alter ego. We have Hego Damask, Darth Plagueis, who is not necessarily a big part of the intergalactic banking plan per se, but head of Damask Holdings, which is, by nature of being based on Mutalist, being a Mun corporation, a very wealthy financial corporation, where he's manipulating things for the banking clan. And you've got Darth Tenebris, who turns out to be Rugus Gnome, this starship designer, and that starship designer thread goes all the way forward until we get to even things like the Scimitar, the Sith Infiltrator, and how much influence he has had on down the line. They did a great job of taking these Sith, and I don't know what I expected them to be. I don't know if I just expected them not to give us much background of what they were outside of just being Sith Lords. Like, I didn't expect maybe the alter egos, or maybe it's just I didn't expect the alter egos to be what they were. You know, a banker, a possible doctor, a starship designer. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't what we got. And I was thrilled because I really liked what we got. What did you think? I mean, did they meet your expectations, beat your expectations, confound your expectations?
I'm right there with you. I found the whole play up of the alter egos was dynamic. And I really enjoyed how it played out throughout the book. But the other side of it was the realm of the physical and the realm of the Force, and the way that Lucino played with that. We've seen it in other books before. Stover does a really good job of philosophically kind of dealing with the same scenario. But I like the way Lucino worded it. I mean, he really put it into perspective, I think, for people who've never thought about that before. And I say that about people who never thought about that before, because I kept thinking about this book as, if you've never read a Star Wars book, would this be any good? I felt like it would be a good book. But then again, I was also, I knew there was things I was missing. I mean, you were mentioning these comic references. I caught a lot of the comic references, and the book ones, I was like, this sounds familiar, but I couldn't quite place it until later. But the whole aspect of what the Sith were doing. I believe at one point we learned that there were 30 Sith in the line of Bane. And I found that that was interesting, especially considering we have Tenebris, who is a Bith, and we've got Plagueis, who is a Mun, and both of those live quite a long time. And the fact that the Bith, you know, their canny ability with math and stuff like that, I really made me think, you know, what were they really doing to help advance the grand plan? And I don't know, my brain kept going on wild tangents with it.
It's really interesting because you have, it's almost like the Baskin Robbins of Sith Lords. You have, everyone has a slightly different flavor of the Sith philosophy and how they approach things and what strengths and weaknesses they have. But not only were they different types of Sith Lords, but also in their alter egos, they were advancing the grand plan both in like the area of the Force and in like the world of the profane. So they're using their skills in that area. Like Damask was using his financial might to further the grand plan, as well as doing it as a Sith Lord. So in both roles, even though they're playing different people, they're moving the ball down the road.
I see. Oh, use one of those terms. The term profane, right? There's a lot of new, even Star Wars Force-based terminology that's introduced here, right? We got forceful beings, for instance. You know, if you can use the Force, I would say that he takes it perhaps a step beyond where Stover took it from the standpoint of Force and philosophy, or at least he adds as much of an impact to perception of the Force, or one theory of the Force, whatever you want to call it, as Stover did with things like Traitor. And that is saying a lot, yeah, because when Stover did that with Traitor, that was huge. But, I mean, he introduces, for instance, the concept, and honestly, I forget which part this is in, but it's experiments that are taking place on Abora, the Hunter's Moon, so to speak, on Abora, and later on the Hunter's Moon, Sojourn. But he's doing these experiments throughout the book, and we find that, for instance, he figures out that it's not that beings that are immune to the Force, so to speak, like the Yin Kori, it's not that they don't possess Force attunement. It's that their Force attunement is so huge that it's an unconscious sort of natural self-defense mechanism, perhaps even of just the midichlorians, to protect that being and keep it alive so the midichlorians themselves can continue to live, that they don't consciously push away the Force. They don't consciously resist by, you know, building up a Force mental shield or something, but it just kind of happens. That kind of thing, or the idea that the Asalamiri, in a sense, are sort of pushing away the Force. They're like, they're using a form of almost like a Force gravity well type thing to create this absence, but it's because of the midichlorians within them. It's not because they don't have them. Compared to something like the Yuuzhan Vong, who are looked at in many ways as just not having that connection because of being cut off, that is an interesting twist. But then you got the fact that they're also thinking of this as, you know, we've heard of the will of the Force plenty of times, and it always seems more like, when they say the will of the Force, they mean like fate. You know, oh, it's the will of the Force. Oh, fate is deciding. Like, the will of the Force is more like a plan, not to be confused with a grand plan, but it's just sort of this plan, and we're nudged toward that direction. Not so much that the Force itself has like a personality and reacts to what we do with the same type of indignation sometimes that a human being would or another sentient would, and yet here's Plagueis playing things out and describing things in terms of things like the Force needing to be ready for such that the Force needs to be bent and seduced to his will as if it is a living thing. He talks about the Force in a very a personalized companion sort of way. What do you call it? Is it anthropomorphism, where you take you ascribe human characteristics to something that's non-human? I think it is. He's doing that throughout the entire book, and it really, it gave me a very different perspective. Right before we recorded, I turned on Revenge of the Sith on Blu-ray, cranked it up, put it all the way to the part where he dubs him Darth Vader. He dubs Anakin Darth Vader. And all those voices, the grr and the rumble, and just the sa-sa-sa, sha-sha-sha that we get from when, you know, Maul is around. I've got a very different perspective on that kind of thing now, because it fits perfectly with this idea of the dark side whispering and nudging you almost to the point where you hear it as dialogue in your head.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to mention. When he talks about when he kills Tenebris, there's a part later where he talks about waking the oppressive heat. He replayed the events from the previous day, still somewhat astounded by what he'd done. The Force had whispered to him, "Your moment has come. claim your stake to the dark side. Act now and be done with this. And, you know, we've had things like that before, but we also see it later in the book when Palpatine does the same kind of thing. And you really hit the hammer right square on the Metachlorian head here. I mean, there is like that feeling of the dark side, or at least the balance of it, where he sees it as two separates as well as the whole. I mean, there was so much going on in the aspect of what Plagueis was thinking. One of the terms I had coined for my early review, but I ended up scratching, was so much Sith lore, you can't shake a saber at it. I mean, there was just too much going on at times. And I love this about this book. Did anyone, though, I want to ask you guys real quick, did either of you guys have a problem in the first chapter, though, as to what exactly caused Tenebris to die? I remember I had to go back and reread that because I was like, now, wait a minute, what does this mining group have to do with anything? And I found that a lot of that, like, kept happening, where something would come up in the chapter and I'd stop and go, okay, wait, what? And then I could get caught on it. I could see people getting caught on this and having a problem. But I wouldn't get caught on it. And then later it would come back and they would explain to it. In a lot of ways, that reminds me of John Jackson Miller's works, where he'll introduce something and you'd be like, wait, what is this standing out in stark contrast to everything else? And then like two issues will go by and nothing. And then all of a sudden the third issue come out and it's a reference back to that point. And I found that with like Darth Graven and things like that, like as this book progressed, that he would go back to it and give you a little bit more. And he was just like, oh, I want even more. And I don't know, that to me is what really sold this book was, you know, I had an issue with the Lucinopedia thing in other books. But for me, I found that the way he was going back and forth with the give a little now and not enough, but give you a lot more later was working, that I was overlooking the Lucinopedia side of things, I guess.
He got you hooked on the death sticks.
Yeah.
You want to go home and rethink your life. Now, I think you're right, though. I mean, he gives a lot of these little tidbits. And for me, I mean, I was devouring this book. I mean, I was just plowing through this thing because I was reading it predominantly during one of my breaks from teaching. So I had a chance to actually sit down and read giant chunks at a time. And in that sense, I really like the fact that, I mean, he lays down so many subplots. It's almost overload. It reminds me a lot. You said it reminds you of John Jackson Miller. I would compare it to something like J. Michael Straczynski, the guy behind Babylon 5, Joe Straczynski, because his whole thing is, you know, he'll lay down like a little tiny tidbit or a reference in season one that's meant to build in two and build in three and eventually lead to something major down the line. And he's really good in this book. And I don't know if I just haven't noticed it as much in his other books, but in this book, he's really good at laying down teeny tiny subplots. You know, like, here's this thing with the Yin Kori. It will eventually give him a test subject that will help show him why you should not use Yin Kori as clone soldiers and why they would choose humans of all species. And just step by step by step, tidbit by tidbit. My concern would be if you had someone who's listening to this as an audiobook, an unabridged one, which would be huge, or if you were in the process of reading this just in the text or the ebook version, but you're having to step away from it for a lot of time at a time. Maybe you're reading this over a period of weeks or a month instead of reading it in a matter of days. I'd be afraid almost to lose track of so many subplots as they go along because there are so many layers.
Yeah, yeah, I had to go back and reread it a few times for my review. Pete, I'm sure you're probably the same, right?
I usually read the books twice for my review. The first time I usually read through it pretty quick. So like Nathan was saying, it worked pretty well for me the first time. The second time I've been reading it, it's taken me about 2 weeks to read through it. So it is a little harder to maintain some of the subplots. But overall, I think the way he did it, I think works a lot because not only does it give him story points to go back to later in the book, but it fits in the whole idea of the Sith and the grand plan and having to have all these tons and tons of different contacts and conspiracies going on to get what they want accomplished because there's only two of them to work with. And it's sort of, even if you go back to the Darth Bane books, where he has all these different spies and connections out there, it makes sense that there's going to be a lot of tiny little subplots coming up through the course of their adventures and their work.
It's called the grand plan, not the tiny plan, folks.
Well, you know, okay, the beginning part, I felt it was good, but I felt it kind of was a little slow at times. The chapter, I think, that really drug out for me was chapter 3 with the Wobegon. You know, I enjoyed the characters. They were good, but I had a feeling like they weren't going to go anywhere. I mean, yeah, I thought it was kind of an interesting little touch. You had something, it felt like a little more real, you know, like a definite working crew. But the thing about that chapter that really was prominent was 114D. And I loved his introduction because, you know, Plagueis, after he ends up killing everybody pretty much, he goes over and he starts talking to the droid. Oh, what is it he said? the way that 114D came to be such a key part of Plagueis's work, he talks about, you know, are you a diagnostician or a diagnostician? Can't say that word. He talks about that. He talks about how he's, you know, does research. He's a hodgepodge of interconnected parts and stuff. I mean, he was basically the perfect droid for what Plagueis is later going to do with all his experimentations. And the way that that droid kind of gets handed down to Sidious later, I really found myself enjoying the droid. I mean, later we see a touch to C-3PX, but it was just like literally like a name thrown out there. But 114D, I really felt like, you know, we have a Sith droid here. You know, he kind of accepted everything, and there was no moral qualms about it. I really enjoyed that character. And the way he was introduced, I mean, the chapter kind of drug out, and I think a lot of people might have problem with that, but I really enjoyed the character nonetheless.
The whole Wobegon chapter, it didn't do a whole lot for me. It did establish some of Plagueis's martial skills, which was good to see. And I did actually, the one thing that I liked out of that chapter was a sort of philosophical difference. You have this crew that's basically a democracy, and you have the Sith who's the antithesis of democracy. It's very sort of an interesting little contrast there.
I would say I wouldn't have thought this until we were sitting here talking about it, and I'm trying to think back to how I felt reading the chapter where he's getting the Wobegon and confronting the crew, eventually getting the droid, which of course is a necessary part of that whole process, get him off the planet and get him the droid. And I was trying to think, what did that make me feel like? Because it did feel different than reading the rest of the book. And it struck me, that chapter and the chapters around it felt to me like the first 2 to 3 books, especially the second and third books of Fate of the Jedi. It felt like, yeah, it's Star Wars. Yeah, it's moving along a bit, but it didn't feel like I was being rocketed along. It didn't feel like I had the kind of propulsion, so to speak, as the rest of this book did, or the type of motivation to just keep plowing through as I did with the rest of the book. And I mean, don't get me wrong, folks, here, this is not an action story. If you're looking for a Star Wars book as an action story, this ain't it. So that's one of the few times where early on in the book we get some level of physical exertion in a heavy sense out of Darth Plagueis, but I don't know. It just kind of left me saying, let's move, let's get to the next bit, because at that point you're not very invested in Plagueis. You've only seen him for a couple of chapters. We haven't gotten to know him yet. I mean, I like the character now. I think going back and rereading those chapters, I'd get more out of them. But until we get to know him in his alter ego and some of his background, I didn't feel like we were quite there yet to be quite as with him in those couple of chapters as we were for pretty much the entire rest of the book. It was just kind of like, is he the good guy, is he the bad guy? Are we supposed to root for the crew, root for him? I think it felt very nebulous still at that early point.
You know, one thing I really enjoyed, though, about Plagueis, and I think that was the thing I really enjoyed the most, was his dedication to learning. You know, in one of the chapters, Plagueis was guardian of one of the finest libraries to be found anywhere outside Obra Sky or the Jedi Temple on Coruscant. Here, neatly arranged and cataloged and stored in climate-controlled cases, was a collection of treaties and commentaries acclimated over centuries by the Sith and their often unwitting agents. And I love how you later see what an unwitting agents look like. Ancient histories of the Rakata, the Vajun, texts devoted to the followers of the Pawala, the Chaedos Academy, and the Order of Dai Bendu. I mean, they start just throwing so much stuff that you're just like, whoa, what is this? But I really found that was some of the stuff that I really liked. And like Nathan said, this isn't really a action book. It's more of like a history / I don't even want to say like whodunit in a sense, but you definitely mystery feel to it. I said in my review, there was a wheels within wheels kind of plotting going around. The strategies that were going on and the way it all laces together, and by book's end, gets wrapped up and thrown back in your face, you're just like, whoa. But the first part, you know, I was told going in it was a little slow, so I kind of was expecting that to get through it. And I think that may play into someone's enjoyment. If you know going in that the first part of this book is, like Nathan said, with Babylon 5 or Deep Space Nine, where the first couple seasons are a little slow, but they're worth it to really get the most bang for your buck out of the last part of the seasons. That was how chapter or part one was. It was slow, building up a lot of politics and a lot of current events going on at this time, but it was all key for later. And you know, Nathan, you hit it right on when you say, if you're going to be reading this over a long period of time, you're probably not going to enjoy this book at all. It's one of those things where you want to stay close up on it. Like I said, I haven't read a book reread a book in a long time. And so for going back in and on my reread, I really was enjoying things because I was really catching things that I'd missed. And that was when I was just like, wow. You know, I kept waiting to hear people going, there's a problem here. There's a problem here. And I still haven't seen many of those. So I think, you know, Lucina's done a good job in doing his homework and bringing it all together. And the amount of lore that he just slips in is just mind-boggling.
It's much less of a whodunit. It's more like a how they done it. You know, we know what the end result is, but how do we get there? I for one was shocked, for instance, by how long Plagueis lives into the saga. But of course, we'll see that when we get to part three. We're kind of approaching a critical point time wise here. Is there anything else we want to hit before we hit the other giant part of part one, which of course is Palpatine and his family? Anything else opening the table here?
Let's get to Palpatine, because that's where it starts getting really interesting.
I think that's a key theme for most people that have read this book. I think once Palpatine walks in, everybody kind of sits up and takes a little more notice.
Exactly. And I love the fact that they, when they deal with Palpatine and his family, they give us some, they give us tidbits that make us go, oh, wow, and sort of get a better sense. For instance, the fact that the old royal house was the Palpatines. If they weren't electing kings and queens, it would still be the Palpatines in charge. So you get that sense of entitlement that totally fits in with the sort of a Sith mentality there. The fact that this man Palpatine, this Palpatine has basically said, you know, I'm not going to go by my personal name, my first name. I'm carrying just the title, the family name, the surname, which goes to explain why we've never heard a first name from him. But of course, the few times we have heard suggestions of first names, one of them has been Kos, C-O-S. From the old name, it was. I won't say it out loud because if you say it, it sounds like what it's supposed to be. But I love the fact that his father gets named Kosinga, or Kosigna. So the Kos thing makes sense. It makes you wonder, maybe he was named after his father and that's the name that he dropped, or maybe the Kos thing comes from the father's side. It's great, these little teeny tiny things he manages to weave in there and giving us backstory to a character whose early days have pretty much been a mystery in many respects up until now. I think one of the earliest times we ever saw him before this was just in flashbacks in the Bloodlines Republic comic, which he manages to work in part two. I love the way they handled young Palpatine and his family issues.
I missed the part about Palpatine's family being the original royal line. I knew they were a royal family, but I missed that they would have been the original king.
Isn't that what it's made to sound like? I mean, it may be just a royal family. Pete, did you notice that? Did you take it a certain way?
I thought it implied there was at least a ruling class, and they were one of like the patrician families, basically, but that they were one that was sort of on the downside. They weren't one of the like favored ruling families at this point, which means there's probably more than one royal family line at some point in Naboo's history.
Either way, that was how I was going with it. But I mean, I guess the way Nathan puts it does add a different flair to Palpatine's past. I was a little irritated though that they dodged the bullet there with giving Palpatine the name. And maybe that's the Lucinopedia aspect of things where I just kind of like didn't quite follow and track it right. Maybe that's the few parts that I was kind of like, what happened? And I went back. But that and when they did the same thing with Dooku, I was kind of like, man, I had a feeling like somewhere George Lucas was going, I don't want that revealed yet.
That's in the notebook, but we can't share it yet. That was really bad George Lucas, by the way.
I liked it.
But I found it interesting when we introduced to the young Palpatine, it's almost like a young Dexter or a young Hannibal Lecter, where he's had to move from school to school for all these little mysterious issues that have arisen. He's this very proud but almost like sociopathic character already.
Oh yeah, and he's already, I mean, one of the subplots we haven't even touched on, it'll wind up being part of our later discussion, I'm sure, for one of the episodes about part two or part three, but one of the things that's going on is all these power plays on Naboo. It's not just that, you know, for instance, that there's a little bit of corruption with King Varuna and some scandalous rumors that pop up. You know, we get to find out where the background of it was, and there's this huge rivalry that goes all the way back to this time. And of the royalists, if not the royals, but the royalist faction, which the Palpatines consider themselves on, there is a traitor in their midst. And even before we know that Palpatine is, you know, involved in that part of the story yet, other than the fact that it's on Naboo, you know, they're talking about this young son of that royalist family who is now a traitor and standing up against his family and providing secret information, blah, blah, blah. And you see that and you go, oh, I bet that's Palpy Boy, you know, and it turns out, of course, that it is. So we're introduced to him as almost a no-name traitor. Even before he's introduced as himself in the book, we already have this sense this is an individual who is a schemer. He is not to be trusted on any level.
Yeah, he had his own morals, and I think that was something that appealed to Plagueis. I like the way, the sense of how Palpatine seduced Anakin. You see the same thing going on with Plagueis and Sidious, how he uses his own stories, whether they're true or made up, you know, to kind of lure Sidious into doing things that he can never take back.
That reminded me so much of Revenge of the Sith, when Palpatine is telling Anakin the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. We find out in the book that some of what he said isn't true, some of it is true, but that's very much the same impression you get from Darth Plagueis' story, where he's telling it as if it's true, but you know at least some of it's not true. And it's that the Sith will always lie to you, even though they tell you they're telling the truth.
Well, I was surprised at how well it still fit in most respects, because things like, you know, killed him in his sleep. I had forgotten the killed him in his sleep line was in Revenge of the Sith. I'm going back and I'm watching, like, killed him in his sleep. And I'm like, well, wait a second, he was able to listen to what Palpatine is saying. Oh, he was asleep and he was awakened by the lightning. Lucino got it right. He made sure that it fit. What gets me about this, though, is I was kind of shocked to see... I was shocked yet not shocked, I guess. I'm sort of torn on the issue. The relationship between Palpatine and his father, the fact that he and his father don't see eye to eye politically, certainly, but alongside that, you know, there's this distrust. It's almost like a I wish you had never been born type of aspect to it, especially in their final confrontation. And, you know, we know that Sith, a lot of times before becoming Sith, or before taking up Sith apprenticeship, or whatever you want to call it, or apprenticeship, I don't think apprenticeship is a word, there is usually some type of test, like a Dooku is expected to kill Sifo-Dyas, for instance. And in this case, that big test comes when Damask, a.k.a. Plagueis, is in the process of basically making sure he's seen with Palpatine in all the right places to anger Palpatine's father, to the point where the father will finally try to completely become dominant over his son and decide his fate for him. You're not to be seen with that old man. It almost reminds you of one of those after-school special type of shows.
Yeah, so, I did.
You know, you're not to be seen with that man. And the dude just goes ballistic. The closest I could think of, I mean, I've been reading the Dresden Files a lot recently, and it's sort of that elemental magic thing where there are things, you know, with these types of characters, you have energy, you have these abilities that are unbidden, and as you rage, you lose control, but at the same time you're losing control, there's a part of you that is still directing it. You may be able to say later, well, I just lost control and I killed them, but you know it is your anger, your hatred, your resentment that is driving those destructive forces to cause all this damage and kill all these people. Rationalize it all you want as, oh, I just snapped. But it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't wanted it. And I love the way he just flat out wipes out the family and then contacts Plagueis like, I killed him. What's next?
And it parallels fairly nicely Anakin when he snaps and just slaughters the entire village of Sand People. You see that the dark side is the path, the quick and easy path. You have tons of power when you're on the dark side. And even if you're untrained, as Palpatine is at this point, he can just unleash this primal forces of nature. It's pretty destructive scene. It's pretty awesome. One of the things that was kind of interesting in this part, guys, was that Palpatine likes to drive really fast in speeders. It's kind of like you have with Anakin and the pod racers, but it's an interesting little character trait that they give to Palpatine that you wouldn't really expect going into the novel. What do you guys think?
Yeah, wasn't it also like a tricked out speeder too? Like it had some kind of after stock or something to it? I remember he's like, just sit down and buckle up, and Plagueis is like, don't drive fast, I won't go too fast.
Oh man, you realize what this means? We've been misinterpreting the end of The Phantom Menace all along when he says, we will watch your career with great interest. He's not talking about as a Jedi, he expects him to pod race some more. He just wants to watch him on, you know, on the holovids and such. He wants to watch that NASCAR type crashes going on.
I can see it now, yes.
All right, so folks, that should wrap up part one for our discussion of Darth Plagueis and part one of the novel, of course, as we're doing it piece by piece here. Be sure to swing by our Facebook page, again, Star Wars Beyond the Films. Just write in the whole phrase, you'll find us there. On Twitter, you can catch us at SW Beyond Films, or you can email us beyondthefilms@StarWarsFanWorks.com. That's StarWarsFanWorks.com, not StarWarsReport.com. StarWarsFanWorks.com is my Star Wars fan audio site that sort of is a hub that brings it all together. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. We will be back. Both me, Mark, and Peter will be joining us again for part two of Darth Plagueis. Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.
Good evening.